Internationally, 1964 unfolded in the shadow of the nuclear bomb. This is Noel Bernard, Chief European Correspondent for Radio Press International. The problems of nuclear balance and organization were the constant concern of diplomacy. On October 16th, Communist China compounded the problem by exploding its first nuclear device, thus joining the ranks of the nuclear powers, said United Nations Secretary General U Thant.
The Chinese test, in my view, is very regrettable.
Most other nations agreed. Inside the Western alliance, nuclear power was also creating strains and stresses. France went ahead with its program of nuclear weapons development, strongly urging Western Europe to form a pillar of defense independent of the United States. The United States offered Europe the MLF, a fleet of mixed manned surface ships armed with nuclear weapons designed to integrate Atlantic nuclear defense. President Johnson told Europe,
"We do not seek to have our way, but to find a common way."
Germany was torn between a pro-MLF government and a pro-Gaullist element. It was left to Britain to try and find a middle way. Prime Minister Wilson traveled to Washington for talks with President Johnson and found that
there is total identity of view between the United States administration and ourselves about the objectives we have set to guide our respective approaches to our allies and friends and our wider approaches in initiatives towards arms control and disarmament.
Wider consultations followed in several capitals, but as the year ended, the problem of reaching agreement on the nuclear organization of the alliance, while at the same time preventing proliferation of nuclear power, remained unsolved. Under the protective shield of East-West nuclear balance, conflicts abounded. The relentless war in South Vietnam showed no signs of ending. It was a constant preoccupation for the administration. To those overseas who wondered what was going on, Secretary of State Dean Rusk was announcing,
"Secretary McNamara is going out this week to have a personal look at the situation, talk to our own leaders, Ambassador Lodge and General Harkins. And so we'll be looking forward to his report."
McNamara went back and forth across the Pacific, but there were more reports than victories, said one McNamara report.
"The rate of kidnappings, murders, ambushes has increased very substantially. It's absolutely essential, therefore, that the government of Vietnam increase its activity to counter these attacks, and that we consider ways and means through increased economic assistance to assist the government of Vietnam in that activity."
The French contribution to the war in South Vietnam was not soldiers, but advice. President de Gaulle proposed a vague type of neutralization because, as his foreign minister put it,
"The experience we've passed through for 7 years in a war that we waged in Indochina left us with the conclusion that it's very difficult to win a civil war, especially when a guerrilla type of civil war."
The Russians were even blunter in their advice, said UN delegate Fedorenko.
"Our United States colleague should perhaps gather up his courage and fully recognize the guilt. Remove the troops, stop the intervention, stop the violation of the integrity of a sovereign state, and the accusations were seized by themselves."
In spite of this sort of helpfulness, there was a lot of talk about expanding the war to North Vietnam. But the threat of Chinese and Russian reactions to such a move tended to slow it down. Britain and other allies did not like the idea. Harold Wilson told newsmen,
"We feel this would be extremely dangerous and would, of course, probably be ineffective, bring in more Chinese, and would be rather a parallel, perhaps, to what happened in Korea 14 years ago.
At year's end, the South Vietnam solution remained elusive. In Cyprus, too, there was conflict between Greeks and Turks. The whole Mediterranean flank of NATO was in danger of being engulfed. Frantically, diplomacy searched for solutions. At last, there was a ray of hope, as Cyprus Foreign Minister Spyros Kyprianou signified acceptance of a UN force.
"Well, we've made it clear that we would be prepared to accept an international force in Cyprus, provided such force goes there under a decision of the Security Council and that the authority of the force is derived from the Security Council.
At year's end, the United Nations force is still in Cyprus, and though the danger has somewhat abated, Greeks and Turks are still not smoking the pipe of peace. Amid all the conflicts, the holy man in Rome carried on his peaceful pursuits. He opened the second session of the Ecumenical Council in Rome. Then he broke all precedent, traveling far and wide to spread the gospel of peace and brotherhood. In January, he visited Jerusalem, the first pope to do so since St. Peter. And in December, he flew to Bombay. Another man, not exactly a man of peace, but one who preached peaceful coexistence, traveled to Egypt and Scandinavia in 1964. But on October 15th, the political career of Nikita Khrushchev was brought to a sudden and unexpected conclusion. Throughout the world, there was much speculation about the reasons for Khrushchev's downfall. But the new Moscow team of B&K quickly sent its ambassadors to reassure world leaders that no change in Soviet policies was intended. There was change at the top in Britain, too. Following nationwide elections, Harold Wilson and his Labour Party were returned to power after 13 years of uninterrupted Conservative rule.
I have just come from the palace. Where Her Majesty invited me to form an administration.
Hardly back from the palace, Wilson found himself deep in a balance of payments crisis. To reduce imports and expand exports, he slammed on a 15% surcharge on imports and gave exporters a 2% bonus.
The first essential is a strong economy. This alone will enable us to maintain the value of the pound, and that lies at the heart of all we want to do to make this country strong again, of everything we want to do to improve conditions here in Britain, and of all we intend to do to help weaker and poorer nations overseas.
In India, the great man of non-alignment, Jawaharlal Nehru, died to be followed by Prime Minister Shastri.
He was a great personality. I know my own limitations and shortcomings. I do hope I shall be able to discharge my duties to the satisfaction of our countrymen.
Those briefly were the highlights of a year in which the nuclear menace continued to hang over mankind. Next, a review of the year at the United Nations in Africa and in Latin America.
The United Nations peacekeeping efforts in the Congo, the Middle East, and on Cyprus captured most of the headlines during the year. But it was the financial crisis, in part created by these operations, that at year's end threatened to shake the very foundation of the glass wall tower along New York's East River. This is Mel Ligon, United Nations Bureau Chief for Radio Press International. The opening days of 1964 brought a conflict in Panama to the floor of the Security Council. Riots touched off by the heat of an election campaign and an attempt by Panamanian students to raise their country's flag on an American school ground in the Canal Zone resulted in a number of deaths. When the matter reached the Security Council, Panama's ambassador, Aquilina Boyd, charged the United States with aggression against his countrymen.
The Republic of Panama is being made the victim of an armed attack on its territory against its civilian population, committed by the armed forces of the United States of America, garrisoned in the Canal Zone.
Ambassador Adlai Stevenson replied
that the distinguished ambassador of Panama presumes to make charges of aggression, I must say, surprises me. I can categorically deny his allegations of aggression by the United States.
After a temporary break in diplomatic relations between the United States and Panama, calm was restored to that Central American country. During the year, much of Latin America seethed with unrest. In Bolivia, strikes in the tin mining industry touched off an uprising that brought a military junta to power. Argentina watched uncertainly as Juan Perón tried to return to South America, but was turned back at an airport in Brazil and returned to his haven in Spain. Cuba continued its efforts to contaminate its neighbors with the Castro strain of communism, but met with little success. At the end of the year, Castro sent one of his top aides, Ernesto Che Guevara, to the United Nations to address the General Assembly. His arrival outside the building was greeted with something less than all-out enthusiasm. As Caveira addressed the United Nations, a bazooka shell was aimed at the headquarters building from a location across the East River. The shot, believed fired by Cuban exiles, fell short. Despite the heat generated by the Latin American countries, both at the United Nations and at home, it was the crisis in the Congo and the conflict on Cyprus that threatened to put the United Nations in hot water. The dispute between Greek and Turkish Cypriots, which threatened to involve their mother countries in a major shooting war, led the United Nations to send a peacekeeping force to the Mediterranean island. The Security Council passed a resolution calling on all parties to keep their heads. The resolution was read by Ambassador Adlai Stevenson.
The Security Council, concerned at the serious deterioration of the situation in Cyprus, calls for an immediate ceasefire by all concerned.
But while the talk was cheap, the operation which sent and supported the UN force on Cyprus was not. And in August, Secretary General U Thant, asking for more money to keep the force on Cyprus beyond September, told the member nations,
"If such support is not forthcoming in the immediate future, it would appear necessary that the force may have to be withdrawn even before the 26th September 1964.
More money was forthcoming. As the end of the year approached, the peacekeeping force was still on Cyprus, and the United Nations was again feeling the pinch in its pocketbook. August also was the month that saw the United States lash back at North Vietnam after American ships had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. East and West traded charges and countercharges. Adlai Stevenson outlined the American view.
Aggression does not pay, cannot be sustained, and will be thrown back by people who believe, as we do, that people want freedom and they want independence.
U Thant always had seen negotiation as the solution to the problem of Vietnam.
The only sensible alternative is the political and diplomatic method of negotiation, which, even at this late hour, may offer some chance of a solution.
But always it was the lack of money, funds to keep the United Nations going, that plagued the World Organization during 1964. The Soviet Union and other nations refused to pay for the UN's peacekeeping operations in the Middle East, Mediterranean, or Congo. The United States insisted the Soviets pay their share, or, according to the World Organization's charter, lose their vote in the General Assembly. The 19th session of the Assembly, delayed until after the American election, was expected to immediately grapple with this explosive problem when it opened in December. But the Congo stirred again and captured the attention as well as the resources of the United Nations. With this and other matters to deal with, and to avoid an open fight in the Assembly, U Thant proposed the matter of back payments be settled in a back room.
Issues other than those that can be disposed of without objection will not be raised while the general debate proceeds.
At the session's opening, three new members joined the world body, two of them from Africa, bringing the total UN membership to 115 nations. And Ghana's Alick Kazan Saki was elected president of the General Assembly, the first African of his race to achieve that distinction. In the Congo, self-styled leftist rebels expressed their opposition to the central government of Moise Tshombe in attacks on Americans, Belgians, and loyal Congolese. Many were savagely beaten and brutally murdered in an outburst of near cannibalism. The United States and Belgium cooperated in a rescue mission, dropping paratroops into rebel strongholds and freeing thousands. One of those liberated in Stanleyville was the American Consul General, Michael Hoyt, who told how he had been beaten and forced to eat an American flag.
At one point, we were forced to try to eat our flags, but it was too durable to to actually eat.
The rescue mission became the focal point of a bitter African denunciation of the West in general, and the United States and Belgium in particular. Mali's foreign minister, Ousmane Ba, in translation, charged,
"Under the umbrella expression of humanitarian action, the American and Belgian governments have undertaken against the innocent populations of Stanleyville and the surrounding areas one of the most murderous operations that has been carried out since the beginning of the Congolese crisis in 1960. This was a premeditated and cold-bloodedly carried out act."
The force of the African verbal assault shocked the West, and United States Ambassador Adlai Stevenson replied,
"Never before have I heard such irrational, irresponsible,
insulting and repugnant language in these chambers, and language used, if you please, sir, to contemptuously impugn and slander a gallant and successful effort to save human lives of many nationalities and colors.
As the end of the year approached, the United Nations could only hope for a respite from the turmoil in the Congo, although there seemed little reason for optimism. The financial crisis and negotiations to find a compromise solution to the payments dispute continued at United Nations headquarters. At the end of 1963, the United Nations was reported nearing bankruptcy. 1 year later, it apparently had not moved very far from the brink of financial disaster. Next, a review of the year's news involving civil rights, as well as a look at some internationally famous personalities on 1964 Year in Review.
People are most deeply involved in the human emotions of tragedy and joy, and 1964 had more than its share of both. This is Victor J., reporting the diverse stories of people in the news on Year in Review. The date is July 18th, 1964. It is night. The weather is hot and so are tempers. And in New York's seething Harlem, anger over civil rights has turned into civil wrongs. Riots erupt, riots born of poverty and discontent, and fanned by extremist elements.
We are looking for 100 dedicated men who's ready to die. We are looking to get 100 very able and willing to be trained, skillful revolutionaries.
I saw New York's Night of Birmingham Horror. But now, brothers and sisters, let us get together, unite, plan a program of activity, and a program, and we'll win.
Across the North, from Harlem to Rochester to Philadelphia and elsewhere, a summer of discontent gives birth to a summer of violence on both sides.
As a mother and as a parent of one of the three boys who are missing, I am making this plea to all parents everywhere, particularly to the parents of Mississippi, who, like myself, have experienced the softness, the warmth, and the beauty of a child whom they cherish and love and want to protect. I beseech your help and cooperation.
This is 21-year-old Andrew Goodman's mother. The trio she is talking about are three civil rights workers, two white men from New York, and a Meridian Negro. They are missing in June in Mississippi, and hope for them dies hard. To some, like the NAACP's Roy Wilkins, it seems right away that the hot Mississippi summer has claimed lives.
Knowing Mississippi, I prefer to lean toward the Mississippi solution, which is that they're dead.
On August 4th, the FBI finds the three bodies. Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner have been shot. James Cheney beaten and killed. 6 months after the homicide, 21 men, including Ku Klux Klansmen, the sheriff and deputy of the county where the killings occurred, and a minister are arrested. But this is Mississippi, and many wonder if the convictions will ever be obtained. Nobel Prize winner Dr. Martin Luther King voices the fears of many.
Honesty impels me to admit that this will be very difficult. I'm always open to creative surprises, and I would certainly hope that Mississippi will surprise the nation and the world in this instance.
People make news in 1964. Liz Taylor and Richard Burton are finally married, as are Dutch Princess Irene and Spanish pretender to the throne Carlos Hugo, after a stormy courtship opposed by the Dutch royal family. There are always those who will be missed at year's end. This year, Counts Douglas MacArthur and Herbert Hoover among those no longer with us. In the space race, 1964 is a quiet year. Three Russian spacemen are orbited for a short trip in October, but both East and West are preparing more manned space shots for 1965.
All cameras are functioning.
This was among the best sounds of the year in space. Ranger 4 finally makes it to the moon, sending back 4,300 previously unseen pictures before it crashes into the lunar landscape after its 250,000-mile journey.
Excellent
signal strength. We're receiving pictures to the end.
Jacqueline Kennedy makes news during the year, although she would like not to. The president's widow and her two children move to New York and try to live a normal life, but it's not easy. The Kennedy Library Fund raises more than its planned $10 million, and Mrs. Kennedy thanks her countrymen.
We want this library to be so much more than a memorial to my husband's memory. I guess we really hope that young men whose names none of us now know will come to the library. It will excite their imagination and ambition, and they will go out and give us the kind of leadership my husband felt this country needed and deserved. That would have pleased him. That will make it all worthwhile.
The sports scene during 1964 is topped by baseball and boxing. Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston meet February 25th for a scheduled 15-round title fight. But Liston fails to come out for the seventh round because of a shoulder injury. Clay is the new world's champ, and he wants everyone to know it.
I want the American people to know that I am the greatest.
Later, the Louisville Lip embraces the Muslim religion, and he schedules his rematch for November. But a hernia operation puts the fight off until spring. In baseball, both pennant winners are teams which were far back at mid-season. The St. Louis Cards under manager Johnny Keene go on to take the World Series from the Yankees in seven games. And then a day later, Keene walks into the Cardinals' front office and hands in his resignation, decided on in September.
It has not been a spur-of-the-moment decision. Ms. Keene and I have talked it over very quietly, and we decided at that time that we were going to resign whether we won the pennant or not.
Less than 24 hours after that, Yankees executive Ralph Houk announces that manager Yogi Berra is also out, but not voluntarily.
Well, Yogi has accepted a two-year contract to work directly under me. And I think with his experience and his long term with the Yankees, knowing all of our players and our young players, that, of course, he'll be very valuable at that job.
Eventually, dissatisfied with his treatment at the hands of the Yankees' front office, Berra moves to the New York Mets to work for longtime associate Casey Stengel. As for the Yankees, before the year is out, they are sold to CBS for $14 million. The 1964 list of disasters includes the Good Friday earthquake in Alaska, Hurricanes Gladys and Hilda's vicious winds, and the crash in the fog-shrouded Atlantic waters of the liner Shalom and the tanker Stolt-Dagali. No view of 1964 could possibly be complete without a mention of the four young men from Liverpool who set the musical world on its ear. The word Beatles meant success in every way, in every land. The mop-top quartet is headed by elder John Lennon, who thought up the name.
I just thought of it, you know, as a name arose by any other.
Paul McCartney writes most of the songs.
What normally happens is that when sort of the girls are screaming, though, people notice it more. I think, you know, that it's a different kind of audience reaction to the one you normally get. I don't know, it's the young people's way of showing their appreciation. We love it.
George Harrison is the middleman, and Ringo Starr is the non-singing Beatle on the drums.
This is my second name, Starkey, so you couldn't have a name like Ringo Starkey, so I just cut it in half. So Ringo Starr it is, folks.
These, then, are the Beatles, part of the diverse world of 1964, year in review.
In these times of instant destruction, you could consider the very fact of having reached the end of a year an accomplishment in itself. And indeed, it is. But 1964 has put man on a course that may encourage him to consider each passing year as a stepping stone on a path that leads to the fulfillment of his hopes and dreams. In the year to come, there almost certainly will be crises. Much of Africa will enter adolescence, and the resulting changes will be felt in the East and West. While the Soviet Union makes what may be profound changes in its internal economic structure and becomes less of a threat to peace, Communist China seems likely to continue policies which have caused turmoil and death. Latin America, too, has yet to find a measure of stability, and 1965 would be unusual indeed if it passed without a political struggle south of the border. There will be changes in alliances, and relations will improve between some nations, deteriorate between others. Some countries will struggle to master newly found strength and importance. Others will stir uneasily as they assume lesser roles in world affairs. But to understand that man can be burned off the face of the earth in a nuclear flash, that the world itself can be destroyed in an instant, is to value life more. And this appears to be the lesson learned by man in 1964. How well he has learned this lesson, and how well he uses this new insight, will be the story of 1965 and the years that follow. This has been 1964, Year in Review, produced by Radio Press International. This is Bill Scott speaking.